Hello, and welcome to another episode of my podcast, Stepping Up. My name is Sue Reed, and every week I provide a platform for people to tell their story of how they have faced and overcome a challenge in their life. Here is today's story. My guest today is Aileen from Edinburgh in Scotland. Now, before COVID, Aileen had been working for over 12 years in Hong Kong, teaching English on a freelance basis. In 2018, whilst in Hong Kong, Aileen had to undergo emergency surgery for colon cancer. Now, although the operation saved her life, the hospital experience itself turned out to be a complete nightmare for her. Aileen joins me today to tell me the story of her experience. Welcome to the show, Aileen. It's lovely to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So let's start from the initial diagnosis then. So you were saying that you'd felt ill before and you just thought it was flu. So what happened there?
Yeah, I went to the local hospital and was admitted, and apparently did some blood tests, and they thought my white cell blood count was really high. So they just decided to give me some strong antibiotics, but they wanted me to stay in for a couple of days. But was self-employed, I just asked them to give me a tablet form and then continue on. But then for about 2 weeks, I still didn't feel right. So I went back again to the hospital. And unfortunately, the Hong Kong system is worse than the NHS in that, well, not too much, but you have to wait for quite a long time. So they did, I guess, what they call triage, and then I had to wait, and then they sent me up to a ward, and then some doctors came along at some point, and one doctor actually said, "Do you have any pain anywhere?" I was like, "Well, actually, I do have some pain in the lower left side of my abdomen." So he pushed, and then I was sent for a CT scan. So meanwhile, I'm in this hospital, and I hadn't had anything to eat or drink. The young doctor says, Don't swallow. If you're going to have some water, just, you know, swirl it around. I was like, okay, fine. So someone came back after a while and says, we found an abscess. And then about, I don't know, a little while later again, he says, we found a tumour and you have to have surgery. And I'm kind of like, okay, just totally in shock.
So you went in with flu and then suddenly you've got to have an emergency operation. Gosh.
Yeah, basically, yeah. So then the nurse came and, you know, tried to set me up. And then, of course, you had to sign the consent form. And then I was taken in. Now, I also have asthma and a heart condition. So as they're taking me into the surgery, I'm trying to explain that, and I've also got A rhesus negative blood type. So I'm trying to explain all this.
Yeah.
To make sure that nothing would go wrong in the surgery. And they just kept saying, it's okay, no problem. That's typical. No problem, la, no problem. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, but, you know, I've got all these issues. So anyway, this must have been about 9 o'clock at night, I think. And I woke up the next morning at some point to find I had a colostomy bag.
Gosh.
Which no one had even mentioned to me. Or suggested that it could be a possibility. So I was like, okay. So I'd missed the morning rounds and no one came to see me for a while, but then friends came to see me that night around 5 o'clock. And the doctor who had initially admitted me was talking about what happened, but she was talking to them. So, of course, me being me, I'm like,
yeah, excuse me. I think it's me you operated on.
Yeah. So I tried to, you know, figure out, why did you do this? And she said it was just because of the abscess. There was a big mess in there. I'm like, but why? You know? And I still to this day never really got an answer, to be honest.
Right.
I know ultimately I found out that they had taken out a third of my colon along with the tumour. I think it was like a day or two after that, the doctor coming around in the morning rounds, because my friend had said to me, you know, find out what stage of cancer it was. And it was a Saturday, that's right, I remember it was a Saturday. And so I asked her. Now, I know that English is not their first language, but doctors are supposed to have some kind of good grasp of English.
Well, especially in Hong Kong, because there's a lot of English people in Hong Kong, isn't there?
Yeah, but when you're in a public hospital, that's another thing I should point out. Because I'm white, Caucasian, to see a Caucasian person in a public hospital was kind of like, huh? Because
yeah.
most white people, most Caucasians have medical insurance for
right.
private
right.
hospitals. And I could never, and actually I never got around to it, couldn't really afford it, and figured out I'm okay, nothing's really going to happen. Because although there's a history of heart disease and cancer in my family, I thought maybe later on in my 60s, 70s, but no, it hit me when I was 58, 59. So the doctor came and I says, okay, so what was the stage of the cancer? She went, stage 4. I went, what?
Gosh.
That's a death sentence.
Mm.
You know, and for the whole day I was just like, oh my God, I'm going to die. You know?
Uh-huh.
And then, that's right. Sorry, I get a bit.
Yeah, no, it's yeah, very traumatic. It's been such a shock. Like we said, you know, you go in for flu and then suddenly you find you've got stage 4 cancer.
Yeah, but that was the thing. Later on, gosh, I was hoping to get through this without this.
I can pause if you like. I'll pause there. Right, yeah, so we were saying you went in for flu and suddenly you find out you've got stage 4 cancer and a large part of your colon has been cut out. So that must have been quite traumatic, and obviously you're emotional now, so it still is traumatic for you.
Yeah, but the funny thing, well, funny, ironic, I guess, some doctors came around that afternoon and I asked for confirmation of this stage 4 diagnosis. And they said, no, it's not stage 4, it's T2, stage 2.
Right.
So for about 6 hours, I'd been left thinking I was going to die.
And that was a mistake then?
I'm like, you know, what the heck? So it turns out it was stage 2. So then that was a Saturday. So maybe the Sunday or the Monday, a few days after the surgery anyway, about 3 days after the surgery, same doctor, after her, I had ripped her a new one for telling me at stage 4. Yeah, you're hooked up to monitors, and I had a pulse ox monitor, and apparently my pulse ox was always a bit low.
Okay.
And I was like, it was probably asthma. Sorry. The pulse ox kept on showing that my pulse ox was a bit low.
Okay.
But since I have asthma, I thought that was the reason.
Mm.
Now, bearing in mind that I was literally stuck in a hospital bed because I had a catheter and I also had another tube coming out of my abdomen draining whatever was left from the abscess.
Mm.
So there was no movement in 3 or 4 days.
Mm.
So she started worrying about the fact that I might have had a pulmonary embolism.
The listeners, what's that?
Pulmonary embolism is like small nodes in your lungs which can affect your breathing and they can travel through to your heart and kill you, basically.
Right, right.
It's like, you know how if you have a long flight, they're always advising you to get up and
put
get
your socks on, yeah. Yeah.
That's right. Similar thing, because it can just, you know, it can just kill you, basically.
Yeah.
So I ended up going for a CT scan. She wanted it one day, but it never got happened. And I ended up going another day. And I thought, well, if this is really urgent, why are you waiting another day? So ultimately, yes, it was confirmed I had a pulmonary embolism.
Right.
And when the doctor came to confirm it, another friend of mine had said, find out how big the nodes are, I think they were. So he came and asked him, he says, oh, I don't know, I didn't bring the results with me. So I'm like, say what now? But I think they're just quite small and we're going to have to give you some medication which you'll be on for the next 6 months.
Right.
So about day 11, I got completely pissed off. I couldn't sleep. I mean, it was a small room with 10 beds, but there was at least 6 of these rooms in this one area for females and then the other end it was the males. But there was always constant noise of people coming in, especially elderly people, because they didn't have the capacity to put elderly in their own wing, if you like.
Right.
So everyone came into the general area. And the ward I was in was meant to be surgical, but anybody and everybody was brought in.
Right.
So as I say, every night someone was brought in 2, 3, 4 in the morning, and you've got monitors beeping and you've got the phlebotic nurse coming around taking blood samples at 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, hell, you could sleep. Sorry for the language, but you just couldn't sleep.
No.
So after day 11, I said, I've had enough. So I said, right, I want to leave. I'm discharging myself. And by that time, I had 3 days of the medication. And they had explained to me that it would take 3 days for it to have some effect.
Right.
So I just told the doctors, right, I'm going, I'm leaving now. Mm. Get the paperwork. Mm-hmm. Call my friend, asked her to come pick me up. But he says, well, if you leave now, you could die. I says, well, wait a minute. Let's just see. Let's just put this together, shall we? I have asthma. I just had major surgery for colon cancer. Survived. I have a heart problem. Still surviving. So you know what? I'll take my chances.
Mm.
I says, anyway, I've had 3 days of medication, you know.
Mm.
Born in Glasgow, raised by a Glaswegian mother. So I still have a little bit of that, you know,
yeah.
Glaswegian in me. So I was discharged and I was given appointments. Now, as I say, I had a pulmonary embolism and I didn't realise until this later when I saw one of the other doctors for a surgical follow-up that the appointment they had given me to follow up on the embolism was for 6 months later.
God.
Now, I'd only been given medication for a few days or maybe a week or so.
Right.
So it was so about a week or two after I went to see the surgeon for a follow-up, he realised that the appointment for me to see the medical doctor to get more medication for the embolism was in 6 months.
Right.
So he sorted that out and got me another appointment for the embolism. Now, meantime, I did a lot of research and found out that Caucasians were more likely to suffer from pulmonary embolisms with the kind of surgery I had compared to Asians.
Right.
So then because of the embolism and because of the medication, that then put the second surgery to put me back together again, the reversal was delayed.
This would be to get rid of the colostomy bag, would it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically it's called a Hartsman's procedure. It's what they did at the beginning. So I was really annoyed at that for one thing, because it was supposed to be about 3 months, four months.
Yeah.
But because of the embolism and the surgery, it was going to be 6 months or more. So I thought, no, there's no way I could deal with this bag for a long time. So turned out I was right, because quite frequently I would wake up in the middle of the night and the bag had leaked.
Oof, not nice.
So
aww.
Meanwhile, having to get up to work, as I say, I was freelance by this time, so I'd have to get up to work. Luckily, my first students were always around 10 o'clock, but still, it was quite annoying and it got quite stressful.
Yeah.
And this would happen at least two or three times a week. I would go back and see the stoma nurse and she would make suggestions. I found a group online to try and get ideas from them. But still, there wasn't really any major help. Oh yeah, I forgot to tell you. Because when I was in the hospital looking for help, some kind of financial help, there was a social worker. And she said that because Hong Kong doesn't really give any much financial support, she suggested I go into an elderly home.
Oh. And how old were you then? 59?
59.
Oh, bless.
No, I was lying in the hospital bed. If I had the energy, I probably would have punched her. And I just said to her, go away. Just go away now. Leave me alone. So anyway, going back to the other situation with the stoma and whatnot and the medical appointment. So I had an appointment to go see a surgical appointment, and a friend of mine came with me. It was close to the point where I thought where we could have the surgery, but I couldn't get a CT scan from them. So that, you know, my whole point was, if you want to see how progress is happening, you have to see inside.
Mm.
But they weren't doing that. I said, oh, no, we can't give you a CT scan for another 6 months. I was like, but I've got a surgical, you know. I had so many things going on. So anyway, a friend of mine paid for a private CT scan, and I took the results that day to the surgeon, and she floored me, basically. A couple of things. I said I was having issues with the scan, with the bag, always leaking. Other times it would just blow up like a balloon, and you would still have to get up and let the air out, and all sorts of issues. And then she turned around to me and said, well, if an 80-year-old woman can deal with it, so can you. But I said, in Hong Kong, 80-year-old Chinese women have helpers. They have Filipino helpers to help them. I live alone. Again, I almost went over the desk and took her head off.
Yeah.
I says, an 80-year-old woman don't have to work. So after looking at the results, She says, right, okay, fine, now we can do a colonoscopy. Now, I was expecting a surgical date to get, you know, get things repaired. I wasn't expecting a colonoscopy. I realised why, but then again, they were putting it off because of the medication I was on, because it was blood thinners.
Right.
So they kept on saying it was further down, further down, further down. I'm like, no, I can't deal with this. I have to work, and I've got this leakage and all this stuff. So anyway, I had so many email battles going on, no idea.
Yeah. However, when you're trying to recover from a major operation as well, and a life-threatening operation at that, and you've got to battle your own corner, that's not nice, is it?
Yeah, plus I'm still working. With no financial support from the government, it's basically just me. So a friend of mine, he says, let's look at the insert in the medication that you've got. And it said that you could stop the medication for 2 days before any major procedure.
Right.
So I just went straight at them again, saying, look, your medication, you know. And then I think finally, was it then or after that? I even got my cardiologist involved because I was having issues with my heart condition. Yeah. I went to see a psychiatrist because I was going a bit crazy.
Yeah.
So ultimately, with the letter from the cardiologist, the letter from the psychiatrist saying I was suffering from a depressive disorder, said that finally got the ball rolling. I think it was the psychiatrist basically that got them finally going.
Yeah.
And plus me finding out all the information that they didn't seem to know. So because I had fought them again with the idea of stopping the medication for 2 days, they arranged a colonoscopy. That was a whole day procedure. Again, my friend came with me and I wasn't allowed to eat. And I had to take this medication to make sure there was nothing in my bowels.
Right, yeah.
I had to flush out my bowels, basically. Mm. Which is not that easy when you've got a colostomy bag.
No.
You have to clean it. Now, another thing as well, I also suffer from hypoglycemia. So when I'm hungry, I need to eat.
And Food wouldn't be a good thing then.
No. So I explained all this to the doctors and they said, you know, they weren't really that great about it. So anyway, the doctor who I grew to dislike very much arranged the colonoscopy, and I explained him about the hypoglycemia, went to the appointment, and I explained to the nurses again, and he had said he'd arranged it, so I explained to the nurses again, look, I'm hypoglycemic, I haven't had anything to eat since last night, can we arrange an IV? I know that works, blah, blah, blah. Oh, no, we haven't heard about that.
Oh, dear.
I'm like, can we arrange it, please? So long story short, that got arranged. My friend sat with me. We had to wait until about noon, I think. And there was a whole room full of other patients, but they gave me the courtesy of putting me in a room by myself with my friend in a comfortable chair. So that was nice.
Yeah.
I must admit, that was about the only good thing about that situation was those nurses were really nice to me.
Right.
And I had a bit of patter with them because they were nice and, you know. Anyway. About noon, they started this conveyor belt situation where people would come and be taken and there. And there were my friend told me later that just before the procedure, they give you a couple of injections to make you a bit woozy.
Yeah.
Had zero effect on me. Zero. I was like, wide awake. And I was facing the screen with the camera where you could see what the camera was going on. So finally that was all done, and then I had another surgical appointment. In the meantime, with all these surgical appointments and other appointments, I had to give up an afternoon or a morning of my work because that's how long it would take.
Yeah.
Because you were told your appointment was about 10 o'clock, but it would be like between 10 and 1 before you actually got seen. Mm. It depended on what time you arrived, because when I found this out, you would arrive and you'd see a snake full of people going up in the escalator to try and, not the escalator, the elevator, to get to the appointment. And then there'd be another queue. So it was a case of you had to get there. If your appointment was at 2 o'clock, you had to get there about 1.
Really?
So you'd be like, one.
So they booked a lot of people in at the same time, and then it's just as they turn up. Right.
Yeah. And then, of course, if you've got an overflow from the morning, then that goes, and then people get seen. So I would spend hours either in the morning or the afternoon. Now, again, self-employed. So I'd have to reschedule my clients or cancel them. So I ended up losing money as well. So, right, finally, the last medical appointment said, okay, everything's fine. pulmonary embolism's gone, because I had another CT scan that my friend paid for. And I said, generous friends, you're talking about £500 for a CT. So then finally I saw this doctor. And by this time, I had built up a compilation of papers from Asian doctors, European doctors. You know, I had like three sets of papers saying that in a surgery that I had, they should have taken precautions, like give me heparin before surgery, and every day during the recovery, they did nothing, right? So I kind of, twice I did it. The medical doctor, I kind of threw it at him. I says, look, this has to be, arrangements have to be made. And I was like, you know, finger, this arrangements have to be made second time for the next surgery, because if I get a damn embolism again, I'm going to come back. And I'm like, so he was going to give me the papers back. I says, no. I says, keep them. Learn something.
Yeah. Give it to your the next time, yeah.
Yeah, not just for me, any other Caucasian person who comes in who can't afford private insurance and has to go through what I went through. So then, as I say, I had the surgical appointment. I did the same thing. I was like, look, make sure precautions get done. I was like, and he says to me, you no respect me. You have no respect for me. And I says, wait, I'm older than you. You're supposed to have respect for me.
Mm.
It was your surgeons that made the mistake the first time. Your hospital that made the mistake the first time. I am not going to go through that again.
No. You earn your respect, don't you? It's not automatic. Yeah, no, you earn respect.
So anyway, we finally got the surgery arranged for the admission date was the 3rd of July, the 4th of July, 7 months after the original surgery. So finally I went in, and I had to go in the early morning, and not allowed to eat anything again, because they wanted to purge everything. I was put in kind of like a temporary ward, and I explained to the doctor again that I was hypoglycemic. Could we please arrange an IV drip? I says, no, you're not. You're just looking for attention.
Brilliant.
So that got me annoyed. And then another doctor came in at some point and said, there may not be enough of my colon to reconnect it. I was like, wait, don't you think that would have been organised or agreed when they
beforehand,
did the first
procedure? Yeah.
So here's me sitting for hours and hours and hours thinking that I might not get rid of this colostomy bag. Meanwhile, I'm hungry. So I thought, bugger this. And what they do is they have like a Starbucks or, you know, some kind of coffee place usually on the ground from the hospital, one part of the hospital. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to do another purge later. I'm going to get something to eat. I don't care. So I went down and had something to eat. So that kept me going, and I kept on drinking water, and a friend of mine came to visit. And then the next morning, about 11 o'clock, things started about getting me ready for the surgery. So I had a catheter again, and then they gave me one shot of heparin. But then they also wanted to put these elastic stockings on my legs just before I was going into surgery. So they took me into this room, and these two young, they weren't nurses, they were, I guess we'd call them nurses, aides, pulling these elastic stockings on my legs, but it was painful, and they were laughing, and I had a catheter, and they were just having a high old time about this, laughing at me. I could speak some Cantonese, and I understood that they were laughing at me because I was uncomfortable, and I just went, I went at them in English. I can pretty much guarantee that because of their level, they wouldn't have understood it. But again, the tone of voice in my face, you know, we're like, you know, do that again and something will happen, you know. So they did that, and oh yeah, what else to do? Oh yeah. So they gave me the heparin, they put on these elastic stockings, and then they put on these devices, one in each leg, that it was like big, I can't explain it. It's got a name, but they basically were massaging my leg,
right?
You know, to keep the circulation going.
Yeah.
And then I woke, went in for the surgery, and I was really nervous, obviously, hoping and praying, like, please get rid of this bag. And so the next, had the surgery, I woke up whenever it was I woke up. No, I woke up just after the surgery, actually.
Right.
And I was in immense pain, and I looked down, and I said to the nurse, is it gone? Is it gone? She went, yeah. So then, oh yeah, that's another thing. Even though you're Caucasian, you still get Chinese food in the hospital. They don't make any kind of
allowances.
That's the word, thank you.
Yeah.
They don't make any kind of allowances to bring in anything like that. But also as well, they expect family and friends to bring in food for you.
Right.
So anyway, because I'm not a huge fan of rice, I said, look, no rice. So after the second surgery, they put me on this drip, but it was a really big needle that went into my hand, and it was just like this white chalky fluid that was in, that just kept me going. I think initially it was just an IV drip, and then they put this in. So I think at one point, I think it was like maybe 4 days. Again, I was stuck in bed for like 3 days, but by this time, because of all the, you know, all the things they'd done to make sure that the same wouldn't happen again. Plus, yeah. I also realised that I was on some kind of air mattress as well, as you know, on top of the regular hospital right. bed mattress. So everything had been done, which just shows you what they should have learned from the first situation.
Mm.
So anyway, so I was stuck in bed for a few days, and then, again, they get you up. Physical therapy, this guy comes along, gives you a walker. You walk from the corridor, literally 5 minutes. So I had to depend on friends and whatnot. Every time they came to visit, I was like, take me in for a walk, please. So, oh yeah, the nutritionist came to see me one day. I think it was a Friday. And she says, can you get your friends to make some soup for you? I says, why can't you do it?
Mm.
Why can't the hospital do it? Oh, well, blah, 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 blah. Fine. So it was a, what was it now? One potato, one chicken breast with chicken stock, all mixed together.
Right.
Can you get your friend to do that for you? Like, grr. So I called up one friend. They couldn't do it. Called up another friend. Yeah, no problem. I'll delay. I've got dinner plans with Susan, you know, Susan, blah, blah, blah. I'll come over. No problem. I said, oh, thank you. So she brought this hot flask over for me.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was amazing. You know, after being stuck in this drip thing, and oh, that was another thing. I had a fight with the nurse. I kept on fighting with the nurses, but then again, they were being really, they were tutting at me and dismissing me and, you know, not talking to me.
Probably they kind of labelled you as a nuisance, I guess, because you were, you know, you were wanting things to be done right. And
yeah,
because you were bringing that up and voicing your opinion, they labelled you as a nuisance.
Probably, yeah. But then again, I had this big, you know, dressing right across my belly.
Mm.
And to do the heparin, you're supposed to put it in the belly, right?
Right.
But I was like, no. And one nurse came up. I says, she's going to go for the belly. I says, no, because the other nurses had been giving it to me in my arm. Yeah. I says, no, arm. And she went, mm-hmm. And then she went away, obviously talked to someone, came back. I went and I lifted up the pajamas that they gave me. I went, look, where? You know, and then she gave it to me in the arm. It's just like, think. You know, pressing on the belly. Where are you going to put the injection?
Yeah. Oh gosh.
Mm. Without hurting me.
Yeah.
You know? Go on.
Yeah, I was going to say. So, how did it end up then? So, eventually, you came out of hospital without the bat, and then. So, when was that? So, you were first diagnosed in 2018. So, how long?
Yeah, it was July 2019.
Okay.
I think when it finally all got over. And then, yeah, finally, again, I discharged myself because right. I'd been there for 7 days, I think, this time. I thought, no, I'm not. And I told them at the beginning, I'm not staying any longer than a week.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to let me go again because my abdomen was a bit swollen. I said, I don't really care. We'll get it sorted. But again, everything worked out fine. So, yeah, I left and I still had email fights with the hospital, but they just didn't budge. They said they did nothing wrong, no matter what. I even sent all the information to the Hong Kong Medical Council and they said nothing wrong was done. But, yeah, a friend of mine who's a doctor said, yeah, they did everything wrong. Mm. And when I finally got some checkups here, they were really amazed at the way I was treated.
Yeah, in Hong Kong. Gosh, yeah. Thank God for our NHS, eh?
Yeah, I mean, they also wanted to give me chemo.
Right.
I'd been told originally it was only about 3 months. But then after doing some research on chemo, I thought, I don't think I could work as well as having chemo. So ultimately, it came to the appointment and they said 6 months of chemo or nothing. And I just went, hell no. But as it turned out, again, when I was talking to the NHS staff, she said because my heart condition, they would only be able to give me a lower amount of chemo and that might not have been able to do the job. But in September last year, I was given the all clear. So
that's brilliant. So all's well that ends well, ultimately, even though it was a horrible, horrible experience. So you're back in Scotland now. Was that because of COVID that you came back?
No, COVID didn't start until December, and I came back in November last year. But actually what happened was, because I'd also been in the hospital because of the heart condition, but again, that turned out to be a bit of a nightmare. They dismissed me because they thought there was nothing wrong with me, but after a CT scan, they found out there was something wrong, and it just... So I thought, no, I can't do Hong Kong public hospitals anymore. So I thought, right, if anything happened, I'll go back to Scotland.
Yeah.
And hopefully get better treatment here.
Yeah.
But then COVID hit, 2 months after I got back.
Yeah.
And that kind of messed everything up for me.
Yeah, because you've not been able to get back again. But it is your intention to go back and continue teaching, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. Because
not go into a hospital again.
Well, this time I'm going to go back and I'll get medical insurance. It'll cost me a lot of money, but at least I know I won't have to go through any kind of nightmare again.
No, you go to a private hospital,
but it was just a complete nightmare. I mean, the nurses and the doctors, they don't really care about their patients. I mean, I saw so many procedures that they were doing to the elderly and leaving them naked and open and splayed.
Shows the difference between, you go to another country and you think, everything will be all right. You just make that assumption, don't you? And then you find out that their hospital system probably works really well for the Chinese, but, it's not what we're used to, is it, at all?
No. I mean, as I say, the second time I was there, the room was overflowing. They had at least 2 or 3 extra beds. There was 10 beds in the room. And they put in extra beds, and there was a bed at the end of my bed. And you're talking about, how much space? About 2 feet between each bed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like here where you can, I haven't been in the hospital here for a long time, but it used to be that you had an armchair beside your bed or a chair beside your bed.
Yeah, I still do, yeah.
So you could sit there, and you had a common room and all that kind of stuff. Mm. Not in Hong Kong, not in the public hospital.
Right.
Beds in this one ward, but there was 6 of those, 6 female and 6 male, so you had 60 patients on one floor. One floor, and then with the overflow you'd have people in the corridor, you'd have people in the front of the bed, and it just was ridiculous.
So completely different. Luckily, you're all right now, and you're, back home, which is good. Good that you came back when you could.
Yeah.
So if anybody wanted to contact you then and have a chat with you or more details, or, is thinking of going to Hong Kong, how could somebody contact you?
Well, I can give you my email address now, or you can put it in.
I'll put the email address in the show notes, okay?
Okay. Don't get me wrong. Hong Kong was great. I enjoyed living there.
Yeah.
I had a good life. I was teaching. I had friends. I had a social life. I was doing all sorts of things. I was sailing. I was going on jumps that I had, going to town. Life was really good until
this happened.
First with the heart problem, and a year later, less than a year later, the cancer.
Yeah.
So it's just the public health system that I had a big deal with.
Yeah. So what message would you leave listeners with then?
If you go to visit Hong Kong, make sure you've got good health insurance. And if
sounds like a good idea, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and if you're going to live there, get very good private medical care.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Right, okay. Well, it's been really great hearing your story, and I'm sorry that you had to go through such a horrific experience, but you probably learned a lot from going through it, and like you say, you'll now go back and make sure you're properly covered. That is good advice to anybody going, well, any country really, just make sure you've got your insurance in place. Just don't expect health service in different countries to be exactly the same as it is in the UK, because it's not going to be, is it? But it's been really great talking to you, and all the best for the future and your continued recovery. And when you get back to Hong Kong, just carry on teaching and doing what you do best.
Thanks, Sue. Thank you for letting me come on the show.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been lovely to see you. Hi, so I'm just adding a little tape on because the day after our interview, Aileen sent me another message to say there's something that she felt she should have added, so I've agreed to add it on for her. She says that when she came back to the UK for counselling, she was diagnosed with PTSD, not only because she'd had to deal with cancer and a major surgery, but also the treatment she received both as an inpatient and an outpatient both times. She says there may be other people out there who have gone through the same thing as me and wondering what is wrong with them after the surgeries. And so if they know that Aileen was diagnosed with PTSD, they can go and get help too. Aileen is dealing with it through CBT and she feels that she's getting better. She says, to be honest, I think it would be a good idea to raise awareness that some people might end up with mental health issues because of what has happened to them. There are those out there who have had to have permanent colostomies, and there are so many things they have to deal with on top of never being able to go to the bathroom normally again, of course. Thank you. Well, I hope you enjoyed listening to today's story. And as always, if you want to ensure you don't miss any future episodes, then please subscribe. And if you yourself have a story to tell, then please do get in touch with me. I'd love to hear from you. And until next week, take care of yourself, stay safe, and I will see you soon. Goodbye.